Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Welcome everybody to another Motorsport Magazine podcast, and my goodness me, this time we really do have somebody special with us. One of our Hall of Fame inductees, in fact, and he's a three-time IndyCar champion, twice winner of the Indy 500, Dario Franchitti, and he joins us this morning in London at the Royal Automobile Club in the Seagrave Room, which is a very special place to be, I must say. It's got a good feeling and there's nice pictures on the walls. We're looking at a picture of Archie Scott Brown, among others. Great place to be. Before we get underway, let me tell you about our very latest subscription offer. You can save 23% on the cover price when you subscribe, and you will also get, free of charge, the ITV Formula One season preview book. Okay? Good time to subscribe, really, because it's a useful book. It's a good book. 23% saving on the cover price if you subscribe right now, and a book as well. How about that? Anyway, on with the show. Dario, welcome. And thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations on the Hall of Fame.
Thank you.
Did you have a good night?
Yeah, I had a great night, actually. It was fun to catch up with a lot of old friends. And then the ceremony itself, that was very special. It kind of dawned on me. I saw Sir Jack Brabham getting inducted, then Frank Williams, Jody Scheckter, and then me. And then on the trophy, it's got all the names of the people who are in the Hall of Fame. And I it's the difficult one because I look and there's so many of the greats of the sport there, and then there's kind of, well, me, I guess, and it's an absolute honour.
I'm interested that you kind of view it like that, because it goes without saying, I mean, you've been fantastically successful. I mean, you really have, you know, you've won an awful lot of stuff in quite a short time, really. And yet it's all been in America. I've often wondered, do you have any regrets about that? I mean, in the sense that, you know, might it have been Formula One for you or not, really?
Well, in some ways you could look at it and say, oh, I could have done this, I could have done that differently, and had a chance at Formula One. Or on the other hand, I could have been like some of my friends who are equally as fast in the car as I ever was. And they didn't get the chance to go to the level that I've been able to. So, no, I don't look at it that way. Formula One for me was always about, if I got there, I wanted to be in competitive stuff, and I wanted to have a chance at winning. It wasn't just a case of showing up and becoming a Formula One driver. And any of the opportunities I was given, I didn't ever think it was going to be in race-winning equipment, apart from probably when I had the opportunity to become a test driver at McLaren in 1997. That was, apart from that, the rest of it was not good stuff.
Also, there's something about racing, working, living in America that possibly is good for a person like you, who appears to me to be a damn sight more normal than a lot of successful racing drivers.
I think the F1 guys are a product of their environment. I mean, Nigel could definitely speak more about that than I can, but I think the ones I know, they definitely are a product of what they're put through and the scrutiny they're under, maybe. IndyCar is a more relaxed environment, probably somewhat like sports cars as well. And that definitely suits me better. But I guess that the way I looked at it, and somebody asked me this question yesterday, I wouldn't give up either of my Indy 500 wins or the championships to have had a sort of a stab at Formula One.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by, Dario, the fact that you know you were consistently a race winner from 99 onwards, in whether it be in Champ Car or IRL, but the titles and the 500s have come relatively recently. Well, did you feel there was a time when it was never going to happen for you, that the titles weren't going to come in there?
I did. 99 was definitely, as far as performance, was kind of the high watermark for a while there. And there was sort of ups and downs, some through injury, some through just us not getting the equipment right. And there was a point sort of 04, 05, my teammates, Tony Canaan, was winning the championship, Dan was winning the 500 in the championship. Certainly in 2005, I was as quick, if not quicker, everywhere than Dan, but which is horrendous luck. And finally, that all turned around in 2007. It was sort of, and since then, any time I've been in an Indy car, it's gone fairly well.
Yeah, it's just been an incredible role, isn't it? Really, it's just the first title and doing back to back Indy and the title the first year. You did it again last year. It's just been incredible.
Yeah, it's gone well. And to do it with Andretti Green was very satisfying because I'd been there so long and we'd been through a lot together and. That being the first one, that was quite something. And then I made that fateful decision to go to NASCAR.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. When you did that, I mean, did you sort of at the time feel you were, okay, that's IndyCar racing, that's done?
Yeah, I probably did.
Because I remember you telling me, more or less as soon as you'd done it, when you got back in an IndyCar after that year in NASCAR, you just couldn't believe how good it felt. Looking back on that, what was it never ever going to, you and NASCAR was just not a match that was going to work?
I think given time it would have worked because it was starting to click actually right about the time that the Chip had to close the doors on the Cup side, and then we went onwards to in the Nationwide side, and the Nationwide, I think my last two races I qualified on the pole and I had a great race with Jimmy Johnson at Watkins Glen, but then to go to Bristol and lead, I think it was like 1,900 laps in the Nationwide car. That it was starting to click, but the biggest problem I had, I didn't first of all understand what it was going to take to drive one of those cars, and my style, which is to kind of try and keep things very neat, didn't work in the car, and I had to adapt. And combine that with a very big low point for the team as far as the equipment side, and it was hard work. So I was glad to get back in the Indy car.
Well, and you hurt yourself.
Yeah, I broke my ankle. Yeah. Yeah, that actually in some ways that helped because it took me back a step back and allowed me to just go to the races and watch and start to learn and understand this type of racing. So when I jumped back in the car, I was better equipped to deal with it.
Dario, can we talk a little bit about the year coming up, because there's a lot of news, isn't there, in IndyCar at the moment? I mean, Chevrolet coming back, Lotus coming in. Things, it seems to be on the up generally. I mean, Bobby Rahal said that, you know, at last he thinks IndyCar really has recovered and is beginning to attract more sponsorship. Do you feel it's a good time?
I do, and after years of being involved in it and watching it decline, it's great to finally be involved in this positive news. Things seem to be getting better and bigger, and it's a really nice change. You know, from 2008 when the series came together, which unfortunately just coincided with me leaving for NASCAR, so my timing wasn't too good on that one. But watching that happen, and then the new guys in charge with Randy Bernard is definitely a plus. We're seeing the manufacturers come back in 2012. 2011 is going to be, I think it's going to be a very competitive and interesting year, but we've got to try and keep the focus on this because a lot of people are already sort of looking off wistfully to 2012 because of all the good news with the manufacturers, and the cars are going to look different. It's going to be different, you know, body kits essentially, the same tub but different body kits. So it's a good time to be in IndyCar racing. But this year I think the big news is going to be this side-by-side restart business, which they tell us the fans want, but the drivers are kind of wondering how it's going to work, and the team owners wanted it too, so they're going to have to pay the bills when the cars are destroyed. Yeah.
Maybe you could just explain how that's going to work, actually.
I'd love to. Once I figure it out, I'll let you know. Essentially, it's going to the way they're going to work the pit stops when a yellow comes out. You're going to have all the lead lap cars at the front, with the leader of the race able to choose which side he starts on. And the second place guy is going to go on the outside. But then from then on, third place, fifth place, seventh place are all going to be on the inside. Very much like NASCAR does it. They're going to move the start points down closer to the start finish, because what we tend to do is in turn three at Indy, for instance, is take off, and it makes us for a spread out restart, and they don't want that anymore. So it's also going to have the advantage of slowing the pace a little bit and giving us more room for manoeuvre when we come into turn one. So they're actually talking about doing it on the road courses too, which
Jesus,
it's going to be fun.
But it sounds to me like there's potential here for somebody towards the middle or the back, while they're trying to work all this out, they're going to drive into somebody else.
Oh, there's always that potential, absolutely.
I mean, it did seem to me for quite a while, Dario, that it was IndyCar racing was just in a state of, you know, atrophy. And I, you know, I mean, everybody seems to speak very well of Randy Bernard. I've never met him yet, but people say, no, he is definitely a plus. The other thing people said, of course, is that, you know, Tony George not being there as well anymore, that's had an effect too. Do you want to say anything about that or not?
Well, it's definitely become fashionable to throw Tony under the bus. You know, and I think even when he was doing the job, the fans, he was a very polarizing figure. You know, I think he was doing his best. I just don't think he was equipped to do the job.
No.
And they've now got, I mean, Randy is a marketing guy. He knows nothing about racing. He's learning. He goes to Donald Davidson's classes at night to learn about the history of the sport. And he'll phone you. He'll phone you and say, hey, what do you think of this? Or what do you think of that? And he takes people's opinions.
Yeah.
And he'll make a decision. And when he doesn't know something, he'll say, I don't know that. What do you think? I do think he's a plus. If there is a slight downside, we just got to be careful that we keep the integrity of the sport as a sport. I mean, there is a certain show element, and even F1 now with these wings and stuff, people are worried about the show, and especially in the US, I think, where there's shorter attention spans and sport is set up differently. Mm-hmm. But we've got to keep the integrity of the sport as well. You know, one of the things with this double foul restart, we said, well, if I'm leading the Indy, and I've worked really hard to put six lapped cars between me and second place, a yellow comes out. The next thing, this guy's sitting next to me again. Okay, the yellow already negates your advantage, but come on. But
but of course, the argument always is on these occasions. I remember saying that long, long ago, talking to Mario about the whole question of yellows, and we didn't even have them in Formula One. And I said, you know, you build a big lead, and then next it's gone. And he just said, yeah, but you know, it evens out. Sometimes it works for you, sometimes it works against you.
Absolutely.
So
it does, that's very true.
One thing I noticed about the yellow flag culture in the States, you know, a couple of weeks ago we were over at the Rolex 24 and you were in the mix of it all. And the thing about it is it does keep it tight. I mean, the lead cars were never more than a few seconds apart, and the Ganassi cars had troubles and yet could still come back and win the race and finish 1-2. So in terms of an entertainment point of view, it does work, doesn't it?
Oh, it does, absolutely. And it's, if you know what you're doing with the strategy, if you are 2-3-4 laps down, you can get it back. So you realise when you go into something like the Rolex 24, you're not going to run away, you're not going to put three laps on the field unless there's exceptional circumstances. So you plan accordingly, you drive accordingly. Although I don't know if Monty got that memo. What do you think?
Yeah. It says it's great, it's fantastic for the guys sitting in the stands, but not so great for the driver who's built his lead up. I think that sort of sums it up, doesn't it? Can I ask you, Ganassi, the team is on a bit of a roll, isn't it? I mean, it seems to be win everything it goes for at the moment. So one would imagine that Penske's going to come back big time.
Yeah, you always got to expect Roger and his boys to come back fighting. There was an award dinner in Detroit recently where they gave me the Baby Borg trophy, and Jackie Stewart had a dinner the next night. And just as I was going to go and have a cup of tea with Jackie, they delivered the baby Borg to my hotel room. So I thought, I'll take this and show Jackie. So I trampled it down to his room, and he had a look at it, and he was telling me the story of when he was leading by 2 laps with 8 laps to go, and the engine pitched. Anyway, he said, come on, we'll take this to dinner. It'll be fun. We'll put it on the table. Lab. I said, no, we're not. He said, well, why not? I said, because Penske's going to be there, and I really don't want to piss him off, because he pissed him off. You don't poke a tiger with a stick, do you? And Jackie's like, yeah, okay, point taken. But the Target team has been on that role for years in IndyCar and sports cars, especially IndyCar. And when I came over to the States, they were the team to beat. And with a couple of exceptions, they have been the team to beat ever since. Mm. And now, being a part of it, I understand why. Attention to detail. Mm. They do it better than everybody else. They just focus and they're about the details. And
is having the B team, as it were, with Ray Hall and
Charlie Kimball.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Is that going to be a distraction or not?
I hope not. Chip told me and I'm sure he's told Target too, when this team was formed, it was not going to be a distraction. It's a completely separate thing, and it's for us, it's a separate team, separate building. Completely separate, but I don't. Right now, I'm struggling to see how it benefits us. I think it benefits the two drivers in that team, because they get a lot of the information from our team. They get a lot of the things we've worked very hard on to develop. Mm. So I'm kind of struggling to see where we're going to benefit from that one.
Yeah. I guess it benefits the series having Graham, an American, in a good car and a good team. So the wider view is good, but. You've got to think about yourself, haven't you? So.
I was going to say, yeah. I mean, Graham's a really, really good kid, but I'm more interested in me winning than him, to be honest.
Yeah. And you're going to get a big kickback from Penske this year, surely. They're going to be out for revenge big time, because it's been a few while since they won a title now.
Yeah, it has. And they are going to be tough. Will was very tough last year, particularly on the road courses, so I expect them to be tough. And the Indy, Roger. You know, Roger's going to want that centennial victory. He wants them all, and Indy's very important to him. But he's. Although I did make a comment to him that night about the trophy being upstairs, and I think Tim Sindrick said something about yeah. I think we've got 15 of them back at the shop.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tim.
Good answer.
But Dario, you know, I mean, racing in IndyCar racing has polarized so much around Ganassi and Penske, hasn't it? And all right, I know there's Andretti sort of around, but it fundamentally, as you say, a guy of Penske's mentality. I mean, it's not good to. I mean, he's had a lean time, relatively in his terms, a lean time for a long time, and I've always thought Chip is such an easy guy to underestimate.
Yeah, Roger has that aura about him, and rightly so. He's been so successful in all types of business for all those years, and you know, ultimately Chip's he's just a team owner, and I don't mean that in any disrespectful way, but that's his business, and he just goes on and quietly goes about it, and as quietly as Chip can, but quietly goes about it and does his job and puts the right people in the right positions. And you don't underestimate Chip Ganassi, because when it's going, and don't underestimate anybody that works for him. They're a fairly intense bunch. Mm. There's not that. I mean, in Andretti Green, it was very much like a family. Mm-hmm. And it's not in a bad way, but it's just not there's not that way there. It's just win. They're very, very hungry, and you got to keep your end of the bargain up.
That's what I mean about him being easy to underestimate, because you know, on the face of it, he's always a friendly guy, and he's sort of seems to have plenty of time for everything, and you know, he likes he has a good sense of humor and so on. But you know, underneath all that, I mean, he is an operator, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, you don't get in Chip's position by being easygoing. And I've seen the other side of Chip too. And yeah, he wants results. Mm-hmm.
You could also say, of course, couldn't you, that you don't get to be where you are either by being just Mr. Nice Guy.
Yeah, I'm fairly easygoing out of the car, and anything to do with anything out with racing, I'm fairly easygoing to a point. But with my job, I'm really focused on it, and I'll do what it takes, as far as, you know, kicking people up the arse, whatever it takes. I'll And as I've got older and maybe more confident and know what I want, I push even harder for it. And you got to do it. It's part of your job. And it's good having Scott Dixon in the team as well, because Scott and I work exactly the same way. And we complement each other very well. And we push the whole thing on when it needs pushing on. And sometimes we're the ones getting pushed on and told to pick it up.
I mean, it's great. I mean, he's a very, very competitive, quick teammate, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. He really is. He's unbelievably competitive as far as just in his attitude. He hates... We all hate getting beaten, but Dixie takes it really personally.
Like you were saying about Daytona the other week.
Oh, yeah. He just... Yeah, and I've learned a lot from him, actually, and the way he does things. He is... I'm a detail guy. Everything is about, you know, sitting in the debriefs for hours on end and just trying to figure out the problem with the engineers. And Dixie was very much like, yeah, car's a little oversteer, but, you know, sort it out. Now he's come a long way to being closer to my kind of way of doing things, and I've definitely gone a little bit more towards his and kind of relaxed a little bit. And that comes for driving styles too. Scott's, you know, captain oversteer. He loves to pitch it sideways. Mm-hmm. And I've on the ovals, I've learned a bit from him and how you can, what you can get away with. And the downside of that is he's learned all my tricks on the street courses.
Yeah,
that's incredibly interesting to me, because you know, normally racing drivers don't tell you that much about how they work with their teammate. It's they normally pretend to hate the guy, or else they worse still, they pretend to love him, which is even worse. We've got a reader's question. It's a good time to ask it, which is he points out that in recent times, IndyCar racing, using the IndyCar as a general term, the cars are much, much neater. They appear to be much less ragged under all circumstances. You know, are they easier to drive or not?
No, I don't think they're easier to drive, because you're getting them. You're finding the limit in different areas. You know, I was very lucky to get to drive those champ cars back in the late 90s and, you know, 2001 with like 1,000 horsepower. You know, and then really sticky tires, a ton of downforce, and those things were absolute beasts to drive, but you got to the limit of it, and if you tried to do in those cars what you do in the modern day IndyCar and drive them as oversteer as you do with the modern day IndyCar, you'd have been in the fence on the first corner. Yeah. You just take it to the limit. These things, the modern IndyCar has a lot less horsepower than you know, 10 years ago, and so to make up for that, you drive this thing you know, very, very oversteery to keep the speed up, and you can just get away with that because it's not going to spin the tires in sixth gear, unless you get it really, really badly wrong. But it's the old champ cars would do that. You'd come off some of the corners and this thing would light the rear tires up at, you know, 200 miles an hour. This thing's not going to do that. On the road courses, it's a different thing again, because it doesn't have as much downforce. It's got less, you know, it's got higher CG, and you got in the power, and it doesn't kick you in the back quite like the old one did. But again, you just make up for it by driving it a different way and trying to...
Dario, anybody I've ever spoken to who was driving champ cars during that period, I mean, it's like Gerhard Berger talking about driving a turbo BMW F1 car. You know, nothing else is ever going to be the same after that. Is that the case? I mean, what always strikes me is, the cars now can comfortably handle Texas. But the one time when you went there with the champ cars, and that was, you know, the race had to be called off. Just give people an idea of what that weekend was like, because it illustrates what those cars were capable of.
Yeah, sometimes when Canan and I will start telling stories, which we don't do too much, but we'll get on them, and the younger drivers, you'll see them rolling their eyes when we start talking about, oh, those cars, boy, they were
the old days.
Yeah, those things were amazing. And they really, yeah, we did. I don't think we'll ever drive cars like that again. I don't think they'd be allowed.
No.
Because they just were so fast.
But that weekend, that particularly weekend,
was... Yeah, well, that was a crazy time, and I think the culmination of that was De Ferran's lap at Fontana, when Honda came to me and assured me all the engines are the same. All the engines are the same. And I was like, it's impossible. The engines are the same. Gilles's got, you know, more wing, blah, blah, blah. And he's just gone 5 miles an hour quicker. And Deferrin eventually tells you, years later, he said, I pulled out of the pits and started pulling gears. And the warm-up lap, I got to sixth and buzzed it off the limiter. And he just started laughing in the car. 250 miles an hour at the end of the straight. Yeah, come on. So those were quick. 250 on the straight is not the interesting part. It's when you have to turn left flat out. That's the interesting part. But Texas... yeah, we tested there, and we tested there in the winter, and it wasn't really a problem. And it turned out we thought we were doing 229 averages, but what we'd done is we'd calculated the track distance wrong, and we're actually doing 234 averages, around a mile and a half oval, which was madness. Anyway, we with the draft and stuff like that, and trimming the cars out for qualifying, I think we got up to 237s, 239s. And what was happening with the vertical and the lateral G? We were starting to get in the first stages of blacking out. I think it was about, was it four vertical and about four or five lateral? And it manifested itself, I guess, with my vision was starting to get narrower. Yeah. And when I was coming in the pits, I kept driving past my pit box. And it just, I felt, I remember the feeling, it was bloody terrified. I had no control of what was going on. It was like sitting in a Scalextric car 250 miles an hour or whatever the hell we were doing at the end of the straight and just hanging on. And Gudjelman crashed in practice at turn two.
And it just went on and on, didn't it?
Yeah, he hit in turn two with 100 Gs or something. He hit again in turn three with 50 Gs, and the wreck ended up at the start-finish line.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah. It was madness. So we went to Dr. Ovi, and he's one or two went and said, hey, you know, we're having a problem here. So Doc Ovi said... to everybody else, brought us all in the room, said, right, hands up, who's experiencing these problems? And one or two went up, and then four or five went up. And the next thing, there was everybody apart from two were saying, I think one of them was Paul Tracy. Yeah. They were like, yeah, I don't feel a thing. And so Steve Ovi called his mate at NASA, I believe the story goes, he called his mate at NASA and said, right, I'm going to email you some graphs here, and this is what we're putting the drivers through. You guys have had experience with these heavy G loads. Can you tell me about it? And so this stuff goes through. The guy calls him back and says, "Wow, we've never seen anything like this. We have never. This is out with anything we've seen. How many seconds are you exposing these guys to these kind of G's for?" So, the race is probably going to be about 2.5 hours long. And they said, "Oh, you're going to kill someone. So just." You know,
stop.
Yeah. And we stopped, and it was terribly handled because the fans were already in the stands and stuff. And yeah. But I'm really glad we didn't race that day because that would have sucked.
Mm. But in the current car, it's fine. Texas, it's fine. So I mean, what I'm saying, I mean, nothing illustrates the difference between the car of then and the car of now. You know, better than that, really.
I remember driving around there at 2:14 about 2 years ago, in practice. And then thinking, my God, I ran around here 20 miles an hour quicker than this. Yeah, yeah, it's a different game now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't like Texas. I don't think it's a track we should be on.
Just going back to the first time you drove an IndyCar, you come from a road course background. Can you tell us what it's like when you first head out into an oval and you're going into a turn and you don't brake? I remember the first time watching an IndyCar and oval for me. It was just... trying to get my mind around the fact that this car wasn't slowing down going into a corner. What's it like?
I'd come from the DTM, and I'd driven it was a champ car at the time. I'd driven it at Homestead on the road course. And the biggest problem I had was holding the bloody thing in a straight line.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Because whenever I took my hand off the steering wheel to shift gear, I couldn't hold it straight because the steering is so heavy in these things. And I'd come from power steering and DTM. So I went back to the drawing board on my back home to the UK, came back for my first oval test, which was at Homestead, and it was the old four-corner mini Indy Homestead. Mm. And I was trying to right-foot brake because you had to brake on that track because the corners were so tight. And it was very, very difficult at first. And I was doing the right foot brake, and Rick Mears came up and said, no, this is how you do it, which was great. I mean, I'm thinking, Rick Mears is helping me out. How cool is this? And yeah, I figured it out. I qualified, I think, 10th, 9th or 10th that day. Promptly stuck it in the fence trying to get out of the way when I was getting lapped. I'd never been lapped in a race before. But it, it was an interesting, very interesting experience that first time. I remember watching practice. I stood on the pit wall. It comes back to Deferne a lot. Have you noticed that? Deferne's in a lot of these stories. Gilles out there, and he takes off, and off he goes, comes back round, off he goes again. It's not that quick. What's all the fuss about? Well, it turns out he was running in his brakes. And the first time he went past at full speed, I about went home and went back to the airport and headed off. it took me a long time to get comfortable on the ovals.
I'm just fascinated to know what Mears actually, because people always say that there's a real Indy historian say the two best ever on ovals were Parnelli and Mears.
He was talking about very much like Jackie talks about in the road course, the way you brake, the way you upset the car or not upset the car, the way you transfer the weight, why you should left foot brake rather than like right foot brake. What the car should feel like balance-wise. So just all that knowledge he'd accumulated, he was quite happy to sit there.
And he was quite happy to volunteer. And
volunteer.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was brilliant. You know, Carl Hogan knew him very well. And yeah. Carl went to him and said, hey, I've got this kid here. Mm. Can you help him out? Over he came. Over he limped, actually, the poor guy. Yeah. No problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought what interested me greatly was you watching Deferne and thinking, I'm going back to the airport, it's a bit like, a Red Arrows pilot. If he saw it from the ground, he might think, geez, do I do that? And that's a great insight, because I think a lot of us imagine, that you're very brave and nothing bothers you. And, but when you saw that, you really did think, wow.
It was less polite than that, actually. But yeah, a similar sentiment. Yeah, it's... I won't, if I can help it, will not go on the outside of a corner or an oval and watch the car going round. I just find it I find it a lot more comfortable in the car, put it that way. Mm. And I'm quite happy in the car doing whatever is needed. Mm. But yeah, watching on the outside when you see, especially in the exit of turn one or something, it'll just take your breath away.
It's staggering, isn't it? Because as a fan, I want to see stuff that makes me go. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I don't see that in Formula One these days. Maybe it's because I'm not allowed to get close enough. But it's why we all fell in love in different ways. I mean, you're a driver, that's a different thing. But it is that, isn't it? Just that.
I think you will see it in F1 this year. Nigel and I were talking last night about the test at Jerez. I was at that with Paul Dares the other day, and watching these guys coming off the last corner as the tyres are just ruining themselves, and watching these great power slides, I thought, man, this is cool. I think it's going to be fun, but TV does not do any type of racing justice, I would say.
No,
the ones that have got it closest are the guys in Australia with the V8 supercars to show the speed, to show the slides, whether it's NASCAR, IndyCar, F1, you don't see the cars sliding. People say to us, oh, the cars are stuck. When you watch IndyCar races, the cars are stuck. You're thinking, really? Mm. Okay. So when I was turning into turn one at Indy for 200 laps, the 500 last year, and the thing is just in a four-wheel slide the whole way through the corner. It's stuck, is it? You know, it just doesn't translate to TV.
It doesn't. You're dead right. I mean, if you stand at Copp's Corner at Silverstone with Formula One, you simply cannot believe that a car or a man or both could go through a corner like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We should ask you about Paul, because obviously about to make his Grand Prix debut with Force India. He's your cousin, and it's a great story. You told me a nice story about you were there the day he found out he got the drive.
Yeah, that was brilliant. You know, Paul and I are... Paul's dad and my dad are second cousins, so we're quite distantly related. But we're Marino, him and I, and his brother Stefan, we're like brothers. I was going to say we grew up together, but we didn't. I was already, you know, when Paul was growing up, I kind of looked after him. And his dad, my dad kind of got him into racing. When I went to go go-kart racing, his dad helped my dad kind of get it all together. And he actually bought me a go-kart engine at one point and then brought my first race car for me, my Vauxhall Junior. It was kind of all hands on deck trying to pay for that first season, and Louis was good enough to buy me that first car. So when Paul started racing karts, I was able to help him, sponsor him, you know, use the knowledge I'd gained and kind of help him with contracts. And then it kind of went from sponsoring him a bit in cars to paying for a season of Formula 3 when his dad just couldn't do it. So it got quite serious in the end. But we were sitting in the house in day before Christmas, actually, in the living room at Louis' house, as we'd done many, many times before, and just were talking about, you know, whatever we talked about. And Paul just came downstairs with a strange look on his face and said, I got the job. I was like, what are you talking about? He said, I've got the drive. And of course, pandemonium ensues. And then I said, hang on, jaded racing driver here, hang on, you've got the signed document. Well, in the old days, you'd have got the paper document and gone, oh yeah, there's a signature. Well, he got his iPad, and he just showed me the last page with everybody's signature. I said, ah, perfect. Okay, job done. So yeah, it's great. It's a, you know, a lot of hard work by him, and certainly his dad as well, to get him there. And it's going to be, I hope he gets to show what he's got. I hope the car allows him to show his gift, because he's very, very talented. I'm excited about it.
Yeah. And like you, he's come through DTM as well. I wouldn't mind you talking a little bit about those DTM cars we were talking about just before we came on air, about the Gizmo cars of the mid-90s.
Yeah, that was, again, part of the deal I was able to help him with, because of my relationship with Mercedes and with Gerhard Ungar. And they saw him and wanted to put him in a Formula 3 car, and we were able to work out a deal. But he didn't have the money to do GP2. I didn't have the money to help him do GP2. And so DTM was that option. He learned so much in that series. It's totally underestimated as a proven ground for drivers. It's a great place. It's not one make. You get to work on the, you know, developing cars and stuff. Mm. And in a lot of ways, I think much better than GP2 for developing drivers. Mm.
Interesting.
But I was definitely lucky enough to to get to drive, you know, along with those late 90s champ cars. The DTM cars were definitely the most advanced cars, I think, on the planet. They were insane. From movable aerodynamics, programmable roll bars, which worked on distance, so you could change the roll bar three or four times throughout a corner, just depending on what the car was doing, entry, mid, exit, phase of the corners. We ended up with a movable ballast.
You got
movable center of gravity on a hydraulic ram. It's not a big hydraulic ram, and it would, at first, the only thing it did when you accelerated out the pit lane, the whatever it was, I would think it would be about 150 pounds, maybe more, of tungsten. When you'd accelerate out the pit lane, it would break loose and fly out the back of the car. those early tests weren't great. But that was one of the things. Fully automatic gearboxes, if you so wished. Mm. It was an amazing time. We ran a full ground effect car with flexible skirts that kind of came out from about halfway down the door. We had these huge skirts would come out, and I was the guinea pig for that one. Unfortunately, had to have a motor to drive a hydraulic pump, an extra hydraulic pump, because these things had more hydraulics than the Concorde, and it dragged the engine down too much on the straight. But this thing had the old you know, it would hydraulically raise the car to beat the right tight rope. But it had some grip, I'll tell you. Those were fun, and I'm looking forward to driving. I'm going to get a chance, I think, to drive one of the old cars, which is over in America now. So I'm looking forward to that.
Can I just come back very briefly to Paul de Resta? Because right at the beginning of this, you were saying to me, you know, Formula One, yes, but not only if it was. I think what you really meant was that with a great team, yes, it would have been good. You know, he has gone to a team that is at best middle of the grid. Is that a good decision for him?
One more thing about a DTM car. It also had ABS, traction control, water-cooled brakes, you name it. Anyway, but
stereo?
It had an airbag steering wheel. It did. It was the first racing car with an airbag steering wheel. Bloody thing never worked, I can assure you. I hit something hard enough to put it off, and they said, no, it wasn't programmed. Anyway, Paul and I think, on that have different attitudes. Paul is prepared and has been prepared the whole time to just risk everything to get into in. Formula One, to then show what he can do, to then hopefully, you know, either develop very well with Force India and move that team up the grid, and then and one day get in a McLaren or Ferrari, whatever. That is the way he's thinking. I was never prepared to gamble everything. I didn't want to lose what I had in America to go to and take that gamble of running around at the back. And that's where we differ. And I'm very proud of the fact that he said, sorry, I'm all in here. I'm going. I want to do Formula One, and I'll do whatever it takes.
Yeah, I just wanted to hear your view on that, because, you know, we've all heard how talented this guy is. So, you know, I think perhaps we're all just hoping he can show it in a car like that.
Yeah, I know what you mean, Rob, but the only point, JYS made the point to me not long ago, you know, that both Alonso and Webber started with Minardi. So, you know, his theory is, if you're good enough, you know, enough people will be able to see enough of that. So, right or wrong.
I want to ask one thing quickly. We've got so much to talk to you about, Dario, but the Lotus 38, we've got to talk about that, because, you know, we all know how much Jim Clark means to you. Last year, we featured the car on our cover of the magazine. Later in the year, you got to actually drive the thing around Indy. Just tell us about that.
Yeah, I remember when Motorsport showed up on the, I was going to say on the mat, but in America it's in the mailbox, isn't it? It showed up in the mailbox, and I kind of went in the house and proudly showed my missus the 38 on the cover. But she obviously knew what the 38 looked like, because I've got 100 pictures of it in my office. But I just wanted to make sure she knew that was the car I was going to drive. And I get asked a lot about driving the car, and I really struggle to put it into words. Mm-hmm. It was... I think because you're used to going in a car and trying to drive it to the limit and all those things, and that's the way you judge what it's all about, where this thing was nothing like that. It was just, I was aware that this car had been not even restored, it was conserved. It was almost all original parts, whether it was an engine or on the suspension, you know, the work the guys at Team Lotus did, or Walter Goodwin and his guys in Indy on the motor. So I'm driving around in this thing. Half of me's thinking, I want to give this a real go, see what it's about. But I guess the bigger part's just saying, look, just enjoy the noise of that 4-cam. Mm. Just sit here and, you know, look around you. I'm sitting in the seat that Jimmy got to sit in at Indianapolis, and just try and savor the moment. Racing is a lot, as Jackie calls it, mind management. It's all about trying to take the emotion out of what you're doing and not let those external things in, whereas this was all about, God, I wish I could remember every moment of this forever. And you know, just that first time opening up the throttle down the front straight, even to half throttle, and this thing took off, and coming back in the pits and seeing everybody's reaction as well was amazing.
I just wondered, Dario, if you'd simply got in a mid-60s Indy car with no Clark connection, perhaps you might have been more inclined to just sort of, you would have been less emotional about it, obviously, and I, you know, you might have been more inclined to sort of.
Oh, I'd have given it something. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's that ended up. I did that at Goodwood with the old E-type 4WPD, and ended up in a hospital room next to Adrian Newey with concussion. But I still maintain something happened that day. But anyway. I would definitely have given it some. But because of that car, you know, it's less than 1,000 miles in its whole life.
That's amazing, isn't it?
That was the thing that really, you know, Jimmy, myself, or Jimmy, first of all, I think one of the guys at Classic Team Lotus did a shakedown, Lord March, Jackie and myself are the only ones I think that have sat in it. Maybe one of the guys, Indy, when Jimmy was running to practice it, when he was bouncing back and forth to Monaco. But
and that engine does make a wonderful noise, doesn't it?
Glorious noise. That was really, really cool. But you just can't, in a modern car, you sit and you use your whole upper body, and it's your elbows, you know, your whole upper torso to try and to just get the thing into the corner, certainly an Indy car. This thing, the way you sit in it, you cannot use more than your wrists because of the fuel tanks. And had all those little valves for moving the fuel around and the two-speed gearbox. Just a great, great experience.
We must take some questions from readers because otherwise it's pointless asking them to send them in. Dario, this one comes from Colin MacArthur and he'd like to know what you think about the best way of getting American race fans to come back to IndyCar in the numbers they used to come. He's from America. He's from Tennessee, I think, actually.
Good man.
Yeah.
Just down the road.
Well,
neighbour of mine. My thinking, I think you've got to get it in front of them first. So IndyCar series needs to work very diligently on their TV package. I think they're doing that, and I think with Versus and Comcast being taken over by NBC, I think that's going to be a big help. But these, as Randy Bernard's fond of saying, these fans haven't disappeared. They're still out there. We just need to bring them back, and hopefully, if we can make this new generation of cars, you know, exciting and catch their imagination again, and catch the new generation, the kids, you know, that when I was 7 years old, I was obsessed with Formula One. I loved watching. We need to get that attention back, get the kids' attention back on the sport as well. And if we can do that, I think we'll be in good shape.
This comes, we're rushing a bit here because our time is nearly up, but this comes from Jeff Rogers. And it's about social media. Oh, no, not this. No, not this again. No, I'm sorry, Jeff. But he'd like to know, Dario, whether, and presumably this is based on your ability to talk to people, actually, whether you think that, you know, things like Twitter and Facebook could be used more by racing drivers, racing teams and sponsors to be in touch with their fans.
I see both sides of that sort of Twitter revolution, I guess. There's a part of me thinks nobody is really that interested in what I'm having for lunch. You know, some of them take it to extremes. But then I find myself now sort of checking in on my friends' Twitter thing, see what they're doing. So I might get involved at some point. I might do it, but I do think I thought it was very interesting at the F1 test at Jerez. The guys were from Force India and all the other teams were tweeting what's happening. Oh, we're doing this, we're doing that. And it gives an insider's look maybe that you wouldn't normally have. And it is a good way to keep in touch and have a closer connection with everybody. But I think there's a limit. And then there's a lot of these fake ones as well. And of course, people have, you know, screwed it up a little bit, but yeah, I think it's going to get bigger.
I think that's a qualified yes, isn't it?
I guess so. That was kind of a waffled answer, wasn't it?
I mean, waffle is what a lot of it's about, isn't it?
Yes,
anyway,
it is.
Anyway,
only in 40 characters.
Yes, that's right. Yes, waffle in 40 characters. Something I can't do myself, actually. What about Le Mans? This comes from Michael Hamadka. I think that's how you pronounce it. You know, Indian Le Mans be a couple of good things to have, wouldn't it?
I was going to say, is that from Marino Franchitti?
Well, if it is, he's not easy.
I love driving all different types of car, and that's one of the things that IndyCars allowed me to do that Formula One certainly wouldn't have. And my heroes all did that. They all jumped back and forwards, and sometimes, and a lot of times, in one day. You know, certainly. Yeah. And so, I've been lucky enough to drive all these different cars. You know, and when there was that one great 12-month period where we won Daytona, Sebring, in our class with the Acura, with Tony and Brian Herta, Indy, the championship, Daytona 24 hours, and that was kind of. And then I went to NASCAR and brought me back down to earth, about 3 seconds flat. But that I would love to do Le Mans. I went there for the first time 2 years ago with my friend Kevin McGarrity. Him and I did a road trip down, took one of my old Porsches down and broke down on the way home. But I loved it, and I loved experiencing it as a fan, but I really want to get in there. But again, with similar to Formula One, I want to get in there in something I got a chance of winning with. I don't just want to show up and, you know, not have a chance. And I see the diesel and the petrol cars getting closer together, which does open things up a bit, so that could be exciting.
Dario and an Aston Martin. That sounds quite good, doesn't it?
You've not, that came very close, actually.
Did it?
I couldn't do it. I couldn't get in because I think I was racing somewhere. But the guys at Aston, I talked to them. Those guys, and I said this to David Richard, they need... Everybody should give him a pat on the back for the noise that car made.
Oh yes, absolutely.
All cars should sound like that.
Yeah.
Even I think the diesel should have to have like megaphones on the back that play that noise as they drive around. Yeah. I've got video that I stood out at, I think it was at Indianapolis, at the corner at Indianapolis, and took video at 2 o'clock in the morning of that thing just screaming away in the distance. It's brilliant.
It is absolutely glorious noise, and it looks great too, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Doesn't produce much downforce, supposedly, but doesn't but hey, for Le Mans.
Okay, on the subject of driving other things, I think we should really ask you briefly what you think about what happened to Robert Kubica, in the sense that, you know, should he have been doing it type of thing?
I asked this last night, and I have definitely mixed views. I can almost see it from both sides. As a driver, he wants to do it, and good luck to him. The fact that he's got that passion for, I mean, I've read Nigel's stuff a lot, and you say that he's a driver. He's a driver.
All the sort of bling of Formula One completely leaves him cold.
Yeah,
that's all he wants to do.
And that's one thing I love about Paul.
Yeah.
You know, he's moved to Monaco and all that, and I sat with him 2 days ago, and he turned and he said, you know what I really miss? I thought, well, here we go. I thought he was going to say Iron Brew or something like that. But he said, I really miss going into the garages and working on my little brother's go-kart. But for Robert, he can see he loves it. And and it's just horrible luck that happened, that he hit the car, you know, as usual. Just when you're right at the wrong spot. And as a team owner, I can understand you. I have been restricted in my activities, having broken my back on a motorbike sort of 8 years ago. My you know, off track activities were severely restricted after that. But there's one part of me says, just let the drivers do what they want. But I just don't see it happening anymore, especially now. It's not going to happen, which is a shame, because it would be nice to, as a rally fan, it'd be great to go to a rally and see him run.
Yeah.
It'd be great to see Rossi doing what he likes to do. It'd be great to see them say, hey, screw it, I'm gonna go do a sports car race this weekend. But the top guys are a very rare commodity, and
they're paid a lot of money.
Oh, they are, yeah, absolutely. It's a real shame, but I can understand where the teams are coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I used to, you know, God knows, the first year I started doing this, when Pedro Rodriguez was killed, I mean, you know, I was a great fan of his, and it broke my heart when he was killed. But it was sort of somehow worse that he was in a stupid little meaningless inter-series race, the Nürburgring. Mm. You know, and I in fact, it was one of the first interviews I ever did when I was a journalist, when he was driving for BRM at Ricard. And then it was 3 weeks later this happened. And it was my first sort of experience of that. And I just thought, oh, you know, what the hell were you doing? Jesus, you know, you're a superstar. What were you doing in an inter-series race?
Jimmy in the F2.
Exactly right.
Well,
just the same thing.
Well, last thought, Rob, before we wrap up. How many current racing drivers could we sit here and talk to who would know that Pedro Rodriguez was killed at the Nürburgring? That doesn't happen every day.
About
how many current drivers would know Pedro Rodriguez was?
Yeah.
I guess you do realise how different from your fellows you are. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago at Daytona when Brian Redman was the Grand Marshal. You remember?
Yeah.
And you couldn't wait when we were going to the dinner on the Friday evening. You couldn't wait to hear Brian talking about his career and his life. Yeah. And do you remember? And JPM was there, and I said, "Are you going?" And he said, he sort of made a face, sort of, "What's that all about?" I said, "Brian Redman's there," and he says,
"Who?"
No. Yeah.
And then he said, "I think there was two words. The second one of which was no."
That's right.
Yeah.
But the point is, I mean, he is typical. You're not.
Well, I see that because when I sit and talk to some of the guys, Graham Rahal actually is
that's true.
Graham and I sit.
And his dad was the same too.
Yeah, so. Bob and I sit for hours and yak on about the, you know, different. What were we talking about the other day? We're talking about the Bell Star helmet. Remember the one with the two eye holes?
Yes,
Bob and I talked about that 20 minutes for dinner, and the other people at dinner were rolling their eyes. But I'll go to dinner with the guys who I race against now, and I'll start talking about, you know, whether it's old drivers or some of the old cars, and they just don't get it. But I'm lucky because my little brother is exactly the same as I
is.
And
yeah,
we can, and Marino and I can go back and forward and we, you know, kind of bounce things off each other.
Yeah, he's just the same. But I mean, for instance, when you drove the 38, you know, how many of your fellow IndyCar drivers asked you about it or were interested?
Not many. No. You know, I tell you, Chip was really taken by that.
Yeah.
Chip was the fact I jumped off a plane from Japan to drive the car, and then went and did some testing. And Chip was really, I think it kind of touched something, some nerve in Chip that I would go and do that. And he has a sense of the history of the whole thing.
I'm very sorry, everybody, but we have to wrap it up there. We've been going for over an hour, and I'm absolutely sure Dario has lots of things to do. His phone is ringing now, which is always a sign.
It's probably my mom.
It's probably Audi or Peugeot, you know.
I hope so.
You never know, do you? Anyway, thank you very much.
No, it's Marino.
It's Marino. Okay. It's a family call, folks. Thank you very much. It's really a bit of a cliche, but it's been a fantastic pleasure.
Thank you
so much to Dario Franchitti. And we'll be back, of course, that's Nigel Roebuck, Damien Smith, and I will be back for another Motorsport Magazine podcast in about 3 to 4 weeks' time. Goodbye.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.